And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
That we can, and so help us God, we will make America great again.
What's up, guys? Welcome to another episode of the No Gimmicks Podcast. I'm your humble host, as always, Brady Leonard. Hopefully you guys are having a terrific week. A great show for you today. I was joined by a brand new guest, the great Gabriella Hoffman. Gabby's with the Independent Women's Forum, townhall.com, and she hosts a great show called the District of Conservation Podcast. And we had a great wide-ranging conversation, all things conservation, land management, hunting, fishing, trapping, all the good stuff. It was a great chat. I think you guys will enjoy it. Even if you don't hunt and fish, I think you guys will enjoy it. Guys, before I get to Gabby, if you haven't already, please follow us on Twitter at NoGimmicksPod. Please subscribe on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you use iTunes. Please take a couple seconds to leave us a 5-star rating and a good review. I'd really appreciate that. If you like the show and want to get involved, you can support us monthly over on Patreon, patreon.com/TheNoGimmicksPodcast. All right, without further ado, the great Gabriella Hoffman. All right, guys, we're here with the great Gabriella Hoffman. Gabby is with the Independent Women's Forum, townhall.com, and she hosts the District of Conservation podcast, all things conservation, hunting, fishing, energy, all that good stuff. So, Gabby, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Brady, it is so great to connect with you. We have been planning this for a long time, so I'm looking forward to sitting down and chatting with you about all these different percolating issues.
Absolutely. And you were supposed to come on like 6 months ago. And it's 100% my fault. There's this bizarre phenomenon after I became a father where I'll just be like halfway done returning a DM or a text or an email, and then like the baby will do something, and I'll like forget that I didn't hit send, and then I'll see it a month later, and I'm like, oh, shit. And I did that to you multiple times, by the way. So I apologize.
Oh, goodness. It takes a lot to offend me. Being a dad and a husband is not one of them. So, you know, better late than never, they say, right?
Well, I appreciate that. So this is your first time on the show. Hopefully first of many. So real quick, obviously your show and the stuff you write about and talk about is a lot of it is, you know, outdoors based, conservation based. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you became passionate about all this stuff.
It usually comes down to a personal connection, why people are very passionate about, you know, public policy topics. And for me, my decision to create District of Conservation and write about these issues across the last decade or so was because of my connection to the outdoors. I grew up in Southern California, largely fishing. My dad and I felt that would be the best way to bond and get close to each other because my dad is very, you know, outdoorsy and handsy. And I come from a family of sisters. I'm the older sister of two. And there were no boys in our immediate family. And so my dad was like, I'm designating you as my fishing partner. And let's see where this goes. And I learned that spending time with my dad led to a lot of adventures. We saw a lot of things. We went to different locations. We would fish off the cliffs of Laguna Beach in Southern California before they made fishing off limits there through crazy regulations. We would go inland to like Riverside County, San Diego, to a place called Lake Cuyamaca, which is one of my favorite places ever to fish. There's like a German restaurant on the lake too, and you can catch trout and bass and panfish and all these different kind of species. We did offshore fishing, deep sea fishing through the duration of my youth. And I first started fishing when I was 8. So I'd like to say that getting hooked on fishing, I would say, led to a lifetime of love of the great outdoors. And it just continued to build and grow. And I think when I was 9 years old, I went to my first national park. We went to Sequoia and Yosemite national parks in Central California, going more towards Northern California. And that cemented really my love of public lands and public spaces from there. And then as I got older, I got gravitated towards shooting sports. When I was 19, I picked up my first gun for the first time. I went to the San Bernardino Mountains with some friends somewhere off public lands to do some target shooting. Didn't like it at first, but I grew to like the sport as I eventually made my way out east, funny enough. And when I was climbing my way through politics, kind of, you know, climbing the ladder up professionally, I would encounter a lot of people in shooting sports, whether they were working for a gun rights organization or some sort of Republican, conservative, libertarian outfit. Just the people I became surrounded by wanted to involve me in shooting sports more. So by the time I was 19, perhaps 21, 22, I really got comfortable shooting with guns. And then when I turned 26, as I was already living in Virginia, already adjusted to kind of the Eastern way of life and moving from a public lands state to a more kind of hunting friendly private land state like the Commonwealth of Virginia, I really got interested in wanting to know where my food can potentially come from. And I love spending time outdoors. And when fishing season is kind of dead or slow, you can always go hunting too. And there's a lot of overlap with the seasons during both, you know, those activities in the fall time, springtime, and then hunting season may end in the fall and you can continue to winter fish for trout, you know, continuing into the winter and spring. And so for me, I wanted to have a balance and I took hunter's education. I was writing about these topics, and I think my interest and kind of, I would say, the expertise I have now or kind of the insight into the sport now, because I don't claim to be an expert, and I don't think anyone should unless you're like a wildlife biologist. But what I can extrapolate from kind of the findings of conservationists, wildlife biologists, not only stems from researching these topics and hunting seasons, regulations, policies, also comes from my own personal experience. And so I feel to comment on these issues, especially, you need to have some sort of personal connection or personal involvement in these activities. And because if you comment on it and you don't understand it, it's going to be extremely difficult for you to learn about hunters, learn about conservation, learn about anglers, what really makes these people tick. Why do they go outdoors? Why is it not just about the kill shot or the harvest? And so I think that largely kind of is the basis for why I like these activities. So I had a personal connection starting with fishing, and then I gradually moved my way on up. And now I do all these three activities, not as often as I'd like to, but I love covering them, especially in my public policy work, because these are the main drivers of conservation. And I know we'll talk more about this through our recording. And these are as Americana as, you know, apple pie. And there's something sacred and beautiful about knowing where your food comes from, waking up to see a sunrise, going out on the water, encountering other wildlife you were not intending to encounter, just observing them, not hunting them, poaching for them, you know, because that happens when you're hunting too. You see things you would not expect. When I went deer hunting recently, took my dad for his first hunt ever, we saw a cow, several cows actually, on this private property lease that our friend has access to. And we didn't see any deer. So we were commenting about how funny it was just to see these livestock roaming and interrupting right. Our hunting trip. So you never know what you can expect in the great outdoors. And I think, you know, whether you decide to do camping, national park visits, hunting, fishing, all these different activities, there's something so enriching about spending time outdoors. And I wish more people would. And I love talking about these subjects. I love going outdoors as much more than I'd like to. You know, I ideally have this goal of wanting to go outdoors more. I don't know if I could spend 100 days hunting like you do, as we talked about before going online. I'm lucky if I can get a couple days hunting especially, but I do more fishing than I do hunting because it's just a little easier sometimes.
Right.
But it's, you do have to have a connection. You will benefit immensely, especially if you're a reporter or policy person, because it really does necessitate having some sort of involvement. If you come from the outside and you lecture to people like this is what hunting is, people don't like that. And we do see a visceral reaction and, you know, taking place whenever outsiders come in and lecture to hunters and anglers, like what they're about, what they're doing without any knowledge about, you know, conservation law or kind of conservation funding mechanisms. So I love this stuff. I wish I could do it more. And I'm so happy you also have this same interest too, because it always makes it easier to talk to people when there's also like a foundation of a commonality of loving, you know, hunting, fishing, shooting sports. So it's good to talk about these issues.
Right. And generally the American population, it's a low percentage who a lot of people fish, but who hunt or shoot. But this is a very right wing, you know, libertarian / conservative leading audience. So the numbers are drastically higher than the average population. But I actually had a very similar trajectory to you. You know, I didn't grow up hunting at all. My dad, my dad did a little bit of squirrel hunting when he was young, but he did not grow up hunting. We just grew up fishing all the time, all year, you know, fishing with my dad, my granddad, my little brother. We have a family cabin in northern Michigan up in the UP, that we spend, you know, a few weeks every summer since, you know, my family has since the early 60s up there. Fishing for just about everything. And then in Northwest Ohio, we have the Maumee River, we have Lake Erie, we have, you know, excellent fishing And then I always owned guns. You know, as soon as I was legally allowed to, I started buying pistols and, you know, my AR-15. And I had a lot of guns. I've always been a gun enthusiast. And I'd always wanted to get into hunting. But I didn't grow up hunting. I actually got into hunting. That was my COVID project, 2020. You know, I already probably fished 50, 60 days a year from February to December, you know, all year. And, you know, I'm like, hey, well, the governor locked me in the house. I'm not allowed to go to work. I have all these guns anyway. Maybe I can buy a couple more and start hunting. And then as soon as I started, I made a plan. I'm like, I'm gonna hunt everything. Start with spring turkeys, you know, small game in September, deer, waterfowl, upland, everything. I'm gonna hunt everything Ohio has to offer. And I did. And after that first year, I was like, well, I'm gonna do this forever. That's it. That's it for me. You know, I found my hobby for the rest of my life. So now I probably fish 40 times a year and hunt 30. Maybe probably 70 days a year, but not all day. But I hit the woods or the water probably 70 times a year. And that's probably the only reason why I can handle working in politics, because I know that the next day I can completely shut it down, go out in the wilderness, not worry about anything besides putting something in the freezer.
That's a good philosophy. And these activities keep me sane too. If I didn't have these activities or frequently travel, I think I would go insane. I don't know how I've lasted this long in the Beltway, over almost 12 years, but I would credit it to hunting and fishing, shooting sports, and just being out in nature, touching grass. You know,
yeah.
I think that's how you, what you have to do to survive here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or work in politics, wherever you live.
Yeah. Right. Right. So I want to start, we have a lot to get to, as always. I don't know if we're going to get to all of it, but, and ladies and gentlemen listening at home, if you're city folk who never go outside and don't care about wildlife and the environment and all that, first of all, I'd encourage you to rethink your life, go reassess some things. I think you're making some mistakes. You've made some mistakes along the way that led you to this point, and you should rethink things. But, even if you don't want to do that, don't skip the show. This stuff affects all of us in some way, regardless, I promise. So, Gabby, I want to start with a recent episode, I think last week, that you did of your podcast, where you interviewed a guy named Dan Gates from Coloradans for Responsible Wildlife Management on all of the anti-hunter activity happening in the state of Colorado. And I've been following this stuff as a hunter, but for those who don't know, Colorado is kind of the ground zero right now on the war against hunters and trappers and even anglers. So can you talk us through what the government out in Colorado is trying to do to hunters right now? I know a majority of listeners obviously don't live in the state, but as all things, when you're talking about the government, this is a slippery slope that will eventually affect all of us.
You're absolutely right, Brady. And Colorado's case is no exception. I actually think it's not an exception. It's going to be the rule if this initiative, I think it's Initiative 91, as Dan told me, if this were to pass, they have to retool some of the language because Dan's group and others were able to force them to kind of water down some of the language. So if they're able to get the appropriate number of ballot signatures, retool the language, and get this on the ballot, what he expressed to me, his fear would be, is that this language about trophy hunting, because, you know, you hear the word trophy hunting and you think, oh gosh, what is this like, hunting lions in Africa or hunting, you know, some endangered species or forbidden species? And in hunting, as you know, a trophy is a lot more subjective. It's not necessarily big game hunting. It could be something as simple as waterfowl or a rooster pheasant or, you know, even a doe, a mule deer doe, elk, you know, cow, whatever. Trophy is what you make it. So Dan was explaining to me in the language what they expect to be on the ballot if it were to be successful in making it or so for you know, anti-hunting opposition. Successful for them, not successful for us, of course. So he says that this language would be contorted and twisted, not only to apply to what they deem trophy hunting, like mountain lion management or bobcat management. This would also apply to elk hunting, deer hunting, small game, predator contest, predator management, everything. And so that language, because he said it's statutory, it even can exceed beyond the state, you know, rule or lawmaking there. He says because it's statutory with the nature of how it's being designed, it can be a template for other states to replicate. And then you wipe out hunting altogether. And we're seeing this now happen in states like Washington State, California, Oregon, there's a tussle over there too, but we see hunters and anglers especially fighting back. It gives me great encouragement to see folks in Washington, Oregon, even California fighting back these crazy restrictions or incremental bans on hunting and fishing. And this is more so taking place due to rogue commissions. And people don't know this, but governors, who you elect as governor is actually very important, because the governor is tasked with appointing commissioners to the game commission in your state. And we're seeing in Colorado with the case of Jared Polis. Jared Polis has a spouse, for the first gentleman, who is very anti-hunting, like viscerally.
He's an anti-hunter activist. I mean, he's been an anti-hunting activist for a long time.
Very long time. Absolutely. So he's an extraordinary case. But he could become the norm. You know, let's say other states, let's say, you know, typically we see oftentimes men get elected governors, first lady. Imagine, or vice versa sometimes. Imagine if it's, whether it's, you know, the first lady of a state or the first gentleman of a state in the future who is also anti-hunting. The first gentleman of Colorado could be like a Petri dish example, where I don't know if that's the best way. So like he could be a test case. That's a better. Or case study, rather. That's the word I'm looking for. My apologies.
Oh, no,
so he could be the case study for, okay, you know, animal rights activists can say, we need to have someone, and this is what we see happening. So let's say this is a blue state Democrat. The animal rights advocates can be very influential in blue states where they have a greater shot of winning elections. So they could say, you know what, we have to ensure that the governor candidate and potentially the first lady or first gentleman, whether or not it's a man or a woman, are they going to be adequately anti-hunting? I think this is going to become a campaign issue in the future, because these animal rights advocates are getting more fired up. They have a lot of money behind their efforts. So we could even see anti-hunting efforts start to galvanize support even among segments of the far left. And if they're not tamped down, you know, defeated electorally early, and campaigns are done to expose how really radical they are and how their efforts would undermine conservation funding in this country writ large as well. So we could hypothetically see people like the first gentleman of Colorado start to be influential in other states, although first ladies or first spouses usually do not carry this amount of significance. I think in Jared Polis's case, Governor Polis's case, like his spouse has an outsized influence as like a first, you know, second in command. And so for him, his pet project is anti-hunting. And so Jared Polis' spouse has been appointing friends of his who are tied to animal rights groups or even extreme environmental groups that boast anti-hunting platitudes, like Sierra Club, Defenders of Wildlife, very notorious anti-hunting group, Center for Biological Diversity, Sierra Club. So they're surrounded and friends with these individuals who they've kind of cultivated relationships with to later utilize to stack them into different commissions and boards so that they can either, you know, prevent hunting as a management tool or not use what Dan told me as I kind of ran out this discussion of it. And I would encourage people to listen to the podcast too, who are listening to our conversation right now, to check out the episode too, because I'm just giving a very Cliff Notes version, but some key highlights that Dan wanted me to convey if we ever talked about our episode, or what I want to convey from our conversation, is that there is a threat too with how Pittman Robertson money is spent. And he told me that the Colorado Parks and Wildlife Commission were two boards that were merged. And funding so far hasn't been affected, but he said to me that when you have these people stacked on different commissions that handle Pittman Robertson money, maybe even outside the parks and wildlife, he said that they could be there to be a stopgap for that funding or abuse or misuse that funding, which is specifically
illegal.
Yes, it's illegal. So that money has to be appropriated specifically for habitat restoration, wildlife conservation, hunters education, and public target shooting range construction. If Pittman Robertson funding is not appropriated for that or dispersed to go to those activities, then it's a misuse of that funding. So right. He warned me and warned my listeners that that is what potentially could happen. So the money is appropriated specifically for those four or five uses. And then any deviation from that would be highly questionable. So it can invite a lot of corruption, mishandling of money, and ultimately an undermining of true conservation. I don't know if you saw, Brady, but from 22 to 2023, there was a depreciation in $300 million collected by the Department of Interior for Pittman, Roberts, and Dingell Johnson to go back to the States. I haven't gone back through to compare the two, you know, years, but there are charts out there that show how much money is distributed. So I want to look to see, maybe for my own due diligence, and I can come back to you, you know, with stats, or maybe I'll post something comparing and contrasting the two different years. But I want to know what states we saw this depreciation of funding in. Was it these anti-hunting states? Was it in states that are hunting friendly? So I need to go back and see where that money lost was. Like, what states? Was it specifically because they enacted anti-hunting measures? Or was it just because fewer people are not going hunting and fishing anymore? It's something, a trend we're very concerned about in the outdoor industry, of course. But I need to do that cross comparative analysis and see where that is. But that's a noticeable shrinking in a time frame where we have seen gradual increase in hunting and fishing for the last few years, especially in wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. So I want to know what explains this depreciation of funding. Why were there fewer licenses sold? Why was it because people were not buying guns at the pace that they were? I think more people have been buying guns, but I think maybe there's a slight depreciation in that number of how many people have been buying guns, but gun purchases have been historically high for the last few years.
I've written a lot about this. It went down in 2023 slightly, but it's still, you know, 15%.
Yeah.
It's still 15% higher than it was in 2019, the riots of 2020 is when everybody started buying guns. So it's still well above pre-2020 numbers.
Yes.
Oh, and by the way, we should mention, for those that don't know, the Pittman-Robertson Act says that tax money generated from the sales of firearms and ammo has to go to wildlife conservation. It can't go into these ridiculous government slush funds where the money goes in one wormhole out the other and nobody really knows, and then it's dropping bombs on some brown people in the Middle East or whatever. The money can't go towards other government shenanigans. It does have to go towards maintaining game populations and protecting the environment and stuff like that.
The one exception where I think, because I'm like you, I'm a conservatarian. I have a lot of libertarian leanings. I'm distrustful of government and I don't like this administration, but this program supersedes whoever's in charge. And I think for the most part, the monies are stewarded well. But then I was just talking about how Colorado could bungle the funding. That's where I'm worried. Not so much about the federal government misusing it, because they have, you know, strict rules. Like, it's directed by congressional fiat. You need to distribute these monies to the 50 states based upon the number of licenses and the number, you know, the landmass of each individual state. And so my worry is where states could abuse sometimes this funding. And I know some people in the Second Amendment world are like, well, you know, if you charge a 10% excise tax, 11% excise tax on guns, it's infringing on the Second Amendment. And I've talked to people in the Firearms Trade Association. I've asked them, like, okay, I've heard this argument. Tell me, is this accurate? And they're like, yeah, it's a tax on manufacturers. But even if the manufacturers were to get rid of it, they said to me on several times that you're not going to see a reduction in a gun 10 or 11%. Like, manufacturers are not going to lower their prices. No way. Everything is based upon, you know, supply and demand. And I asked them, okay, so does this infringe the Second Amendment? And they said, if we would have found that to be the case, we would have never supported Pittman Robertson because of just how these monies are generally stewarded. The Tax Foundation said it's one of the best executed excise taxes ever, because people see where that money is going to. They see that wildlife numbers are boosted. They see that fisheries are bolstered. They see that the habitat is being improved, unlike what you hear from virtue signaling environmentalists who have really no impact on improving wild spaces, even though they talk a great deal about doing so. So you do see where these monies are going. It's been a largely successful program. Is it perfect? Nothing is perfect.
It's not perfect, but it is certainly the government program with maybe the only government program that has any semblance of transparency. It is
exactly.
You can trace where the money goes, at least for now. like you mentioned, you know, Colorado's trying to fudge those numbers, but it is, you can go and trace where those monies are being spent. It is probably the most efficient and well-run and transparent program the government has ever been engaged in, at least in the last 100 or so years.
You're absolutely correct, because we see so much waste and fraud. I don't know. IRS is one example.
Yes.
We see it all across the board. So to me, because, I mean, people forget this was a self-imposed tax. This was people at the turn of the 20th century who said, we're going to lose out on this precious wildlife that sustains us and nourishes us if we resort to market game hunting. And I think we can kind of tweak certain things. Like, we have so much white-tailed deer and mule, more so white-tailed deer than mule deer. But I think this is the same in Ohio like it is here in Virginia. We're overrun with deer. And if I want to buy deer in the grocery store, I think there are ways that we can do this without creating another kind of market game problem. Right. I've heard some chatter among people who've said, like, we should kind of reform, maybe work with the USDA to make it more feasible, so we're not getting like New Zealand deer. You've seen this, right? And like right. some of the grocery stores, like they import it from other countries, but we can't get all this type of wild game meat here. And like I said, I am concerned about, you know, people creating a black market for deer meat. I don't want that again. But I think if it's done very carefully, very judiciously, maybe we can see people eat venison in a more feasible way. But we actually just passed in Virginia. I think the Governor Youngkin, I think, might sign this into law soon if it crossed both houses. I know it got unanimous support or near unanimous support in our House of Delegates, but I think a lot of states have this. Maybe yours does too. Correct me if I'm wrong. But in Virginia soon, if Youngkin signs this bill into law, and I'm not going to sell this wild game meat, but because you shouldn't and you can't, but you can pick up roadkill soon in Virginia if this were to liberalize the current regulations outside of hunting season and for four species. So it would be black bear, deer, elk, and I think turkey is the other one. So if you see roadkill on the side of the road, any corner of Virginia, and you want to take it, it looks okay, edible, you just have to call. I believe it's going to be probably like a phone number, like where you would report like snakehead or like an invasive fish you caught, you right. know, and report that, hey, I was able to get this. So I think they're probably going to create a similar system if this were to pass and become law very soon. And so it's just, you call the number and you report where you got it, what it is. And then if you're comfortable preparing this game meat in question, you can take it home and eat it. Instead of seeing that language, because I learned that our Department of Transportation just discards this into landfill, like freshly killed meat. That's so stupid. And it's, I know, crazy. There's a fear about eating roadkill. Granted, it's just taboo right now, but I think people can demystify it, and it should be largely safe unless like birds of prey, or if like vultures have eaten it. Like, as long as it hasn't been pecked and it's freshly killed, it should largely be okay to prepare, field dress, and consume it, as long as it doesn't have any problems with it. So that's kind of, you know, with Pittman Robertson, why I think it's one of the few efficient government programs. And maybe we could explore a little bit more about this, Brady. I've seen some Republicans push for efforts, again, claiming that it's an infringement on the Second Amendment, right? And I can't help but shudder and think, like, they always talk about some of these, I think it was 50 co-signers of, it was called the Return Act. It's a vanity bill. It's not really going to get any traction. There's no appetite to repeal Pittman Robertson or Dingell Johnson, thankfully, because people do see largely that it has been successful. And you can't really make this Second Amendment infringement article argument with this. And so when I saw 50 Republicans sign on to this on the House, I was very disappointed. I even called up the key sponsor of the bill, who's generally a good, you know, lawmaker, but I thought he was extremely short-sighted on this. And his press secretary lashed out at me, saying I was engaging in misinformation. So I didn't qualify her email with a response. I was like, this is unprofessional. I don't need to deal with this. My friend had actually interviewed him. I thought he did a really good job confronting him about, like, sir, this is short-sighted. Do you understand what you're doing? And he was still very much attached to the support of the bill and really didn't care about any information, because he's an FFL and he thought he would benefit, you know, from making more money from doing that. So I think a lot of Second Amendment people have to kind of question and be like, is he doing this really because of the Second Amendment, or is he going to be making more money, he thinks? And then they were talking about how, well, we'll replace whatever we lose from Pittman Robertson with offshore oil and gas development. And I was thinking to myself, you're proposing this in a time where you have an administration that's stopping offshore oil and gas exploration. Like, you're going to lose.
You can't. That's never going to work with a Democrat regime.
No.
Controlling the offshore permits and whatnot. But that's also, if he's making the, look, I'm an anarchist. So if I were a member of Congress or a senator, I would vote how Ron Paul voted. And definitionally, yes, Pittman Robertson is a violation of the Second Amendment. At least in my eyes, it is. I can walk and chew gum at the same time. So, like, ideologically speaking, let's say if I were a member of Congress, I would vote to eliminate all taxation. because I believe it's evil. I believe forcing people to do stuff they don't want to do at gunpoint is inherently and self-evidently immoral. At the same time, let's say I were emperor for the day and I were eliminating government programs, I'd probably come after Pittman Robertson last, okay? Yeah. So it's like once we've gotten rid of the Federal Reserve and the IRS and the FBI and the CIA, we've audited the Defense Department, we've gotten rid of entitlements and reformed all that. Like once I've done my best Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge impression and slashed the federal government by 70%, then maybe we can talk about Pittman Robertson. But let's just say even if I were Rand Paul or Mike Lee, one of these libertarians in a position of power, that'd be the last thing on my list of priorities. There's a lot more egregious acts being perpetrated by the government on a daily basis than that. So that's not really something
it's really low-hanging fruit. And yes, when you think about it, like, there's a lot more positives than negatives to it. So I believe in it. I like it. It can be certainly improved. And I think more so we have to watch where the states are going with PR funding. But yes, Colorado is center stage. Going back to your original question of this, and even if you don't mountain lion hunt or bobcat hunt, and I don't think I would do that myself. I support it, but I don't have a desire to personally do it myself. At this point in time, I have tasted bobcat before. One of my friends is a game chef, and he was like, I have game jerky for you to try. Guess what flavor it is? And I'm like, I don't know. Surprise me. And then when I take a bite and he tells me, I'm like, you fed me bobcat? You fed me coyote? Like, what is this? So he's like, see? I didn't have to tell you what it is and you thought it was good. I was like, yes, I admit this was good. And so, you know, you can eat them if you want. And the pelts are really cool too. I have no problem with that as well. But I mean, most people are going to harvest that because it's, you know, you need to manage mountain lions and bobcats. But as I mentioned earlier, Dan had expressed that this trophy statutory language would apply to all game species, all types of hunting. So it is really a kind of a clarion call to watch what happens in the states, because what could happen in one state could definitely be exported to your state. And we have seen this happen many, many times. We've seen nationwide, you know, I've seen in Virginia, we have a largely pro-hunting majority, even, you know, with a divided government right now with a Republican governor and a slightly Dem-tilt General Assembly. The people we have appointed to our game agency, some of them are holdovers from the Northam administration or even McAuliffe administrations. And then you have, of course, appointees from Youngkin. For the most part, they have largely been pro-hunting, pro-conservation. And even on the mission statement in Virginia, it says we support hunting as a management tool. So I don't see that happening. I don't see that changing, thankfully, anytime soon. But what if after Youngkin, there is someone who's elected who's very anti-hunting? It gives me great fear to think that like an Abigail Spanberger or someone else running could potentially be governor. I hate to admit this, like it's so early, but my worry is like a Spanberger type could be elected to office. I don't know what her records are with animal rights groups, but I'm kind of thinking she may have.
I would imagine very bad.
Yeah.
If I had to guess.
I think she may be sympathetic to them. I have to go back in her record and see. But I worry that the next person after Youngkin, because we usually go, you know, back and forth between the different parties. The exception we had was we had two back-to-back governors. That's usually not the case for the most part in recent memory. You kind of flip back and forth. But Virginia has increasingly trended blue. So I worry down the road in the future, if we get another Democratic administration in Richmond, we could see anti-hunting majorities because Virginia is becoming a lot more urban. With kind of the different, like Alexandria, Richmond, you know, Tidewater, Charlottesville, whatever. As the population kind of trends more urban and maybe not so much hunting friendly, that could happen in any state. I mean, it could happen in Pennsylvania in the future. Right now, I don't think it's going to happen there, but we see a lot of the northeastern states be subjected to this right now, like states that historically had hunting and fishing as foundational activities. You know, the colonial period, you know, that's how the people there first subsisted and survived. They went hunting and fishing, and you still find that culture a lot in like New Hampshire, Maine, etc. But you see those states changing politically and they're losing that kind of heritage, that outdoor heritage. And kind of the point I wanted to make overall is, you know, I don't want to make hunting and fishing partisan, but in kind of my observation, you know, into these activities, these activities generally fare better when you have Republicans in office. There are exceptions to the rule. There are anti-hunting, pro-animal rights Republicans. There was one, who was it? Actually, Kristen Sinema beat her. The lady, Sally McSally? I think she was Senator McSally.
Yeah,
was there.
McSally.
She was appointed by Doug Ducey. So I had learned, believe it or not, that actually Kyrsten Sinema, Senator Sinema, who's going to be leaving, retiring at the end of the year, she actually, from what insiders in Arizona told me, she won by the margin she did because she actually quietly appealed to big game hunters and hunters. McSally was in the books or was in the pocket of rather Humane Society. That was a very interesting dynamic. You normally hear in the reverse that the Democrats are in the pockets of these radical animal rights activist groups, but it was the reverse. So Sinema, it consequently won because she had kind of this quiet, silent hunting majority that supported her versus the Republican, who typically would be viewed as a pro-hunting ally, pro-fishing ally, but no. But generally speaking, these activities do fare better generally under Republicans. Like I said, there are some exceptions to the rule. I don't like the Return Act. I hope some of those Republicans have had kind of a reassessment of supporting that bill. But like I said, it's a vanity bill. It's not going anywhere. It's just a way for, I think it was Representative Clyde and others, just to be like, hey, supporters, this is my dedication to you. And until, you know, the argument can be made that it actually is an infringement on the Second Amendment, we're not going to see that funding done away. And I don't want to see that funding done away. Because it would be nice, you know, to keep the system in place. Like, we have a system that is the envy of the world. Like, other countries look to us and say, America has managed under the North American model. They've reintroduced species that were on the brink of extinction. They have beautiful wild spaces, even amidst all this development. And there's some pristine waters, pristine wilderness, you know, so many plentiful wildlife. And certainly some wildlife are struggling and can make a comeback, and buffalo, bison are making a comeback slowly but surely, and other species that have languished are starting to come back, just because people are a lot more conscious, and you have to thank hunters and anglers for that too, with all the money we pump back into conservation through PR, Dingell Johnson funds. And so we don't want to bite the hand that feeds us and interrupt a system that is good. And like I said, we can make improvements along the way, and I feel more confident when we have, you know, conservative or libertarian administrations or thinking at administrations where you do see conservation heralded. Like Trump, yes, has a lot of quirks and he is, you know, a bomb thrower in many ways. But when he was in office, the people he had at Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA, DOE, all these agencies were not these radical preservationists who said, let's eliminate hunters and anglers. They actually listened to hunters and anglers. You were seeing improvements. You were seeing fewer encroachments on property rights. You were seeing fewer directives attacking multiple use management of public lands, attacking your ability to, you know, use lead tackle and bullets on public lands. So I think hunters and anglers can feel extremely comfortable, even, like I said, with kind of a oddball, let's say, for instance, a nominee, a kind of unpredictable guy. We've seen what he does on conservation in the past. So I know for the most part, at least hunting and fishing will be protected, safeguarded, and restored if we were to get a hypothetical Trump administration back. What Biden is doing quietly and even openly, it has me extremely worried. Like I follow, as you know, Brady, I follow this stuff very closely. And a lot of people don't know that behind the scenes with a lot of rulemaking, they're making it extremely harder to do hunting in very commonly, you know, common hunting and fishing areas, or they're putting caveats, or they're saying you can't recreationally access this point because you're going to be disturbing trails, you know, for OHV or ATV. Out west, there's this big movement to shut off, you know, motor vehicle access, and motor vehicle access is extremely important for people who may have mobility issues.
Yeah.
And it's a fun, you know, activity to do. Why are you restricting that form of recreation and, you know, closing off public lands for preferred uses, or rather non-uses? That's what we're seeing. And so what they're doing is not conservation. It's preservation, even rewilding, which is even more dangerous than preservation, because you need a little preservation. Like, I support protecting antiquities on some national monuments. I support, you know, the 63, 64 national parks we have. I don't think everything should be a national park. That's a dangerous way of thinking, because then you severely alter what conservation is. And so you have to think conservation, not preservation, and especially not rewilding with the grand scheme of things. But when I go around the country to lecture to college students or different events, like I'm even talking to center right audiences who don't know about this. And they're like, whoa, I didn't know this is how I can communicate environmentalism to the public. And I'm like, yeah, we can have a say in environmentalism without necessarily copying or mimicking the left, because sometimes people on the right have this problem of saying, we're like the left on environmentalism. We may want to delay, you know, net zero by 10 years, or we still have the same, you know, clean energy goals. And I'm like, that's a cop out. We shouldn't be saying that. We have to have our own foundational principles, you know, rooted in limited government, trusting the individual, really upholding property rights, having kind of a federalist approach to management of public lands, forests, what have you, and really involving private stakeholders, cutting red tape, making sure that you don't have onerous regulations hamstringing people and their livelihoods. Because when people are less hamstrung and less attacked, they're going to be more motivated and cooperative to actually participate in conservation. We've seen this time and time again with anything, you know, simple economics. If you tax someone into oblivion, why are they going to want to pay taxes? Or if you punish someone, you know, punitively for something, you know, you go after them through regulations. You know, we've seen different people across different issues. I'm trying to think what's a good example. Oh, we had, I think it was cake pop bakeries were like occupational licensing reform, you know, this type of stuff, a tax on small business, for instance. So these people get pummeled with regulation until occupational licensing reform occurs and they don't have to go through the hoops to restart their business in a new state or what have you. And so it's the same with conservation. When you put these onerous regulations on ranchers, farmers, hunters, anglers, landowners, they're not going to want to cooperate with the government. And then you see them, you know, getting out of the equation, and then environmentalists take over and cause chaos on the landscape. And you know, you have discord, and you don't want that. And so with kind of a limited government federalist thinking, which can definitely align with conservation, I definitely think so, you'll see a lot more betterment of the environment, where you don't have these taxation policies, where you don't have net zero pushes, and where you don't have, you know, the government restricting innovation, you know, for things like nuclear energy, which is a lot more preferable to me as a clean energy source than utility scale solar or utility scale wind. And that's kind of a lot unpacking from Colorado to PR. Regulation.
That's all good. That's all important. And a couple points on what you just said. My only problem with the national park system is that, I mean, a lot of these natural parks are expanding, and that's not a, I mean, I'm glad that they're there. I'm glad Americans can visit these national parks whenever they want and all that. But that's actually, it's not a real depiction of what wildlife on this continent have been for a long time, because human beings, human hunters have hunted every game population on this continent for 10,000 years. You know, going back to the Clovis era, you know what I mean? Going back to Stone Point tools and stuff like that, you know, human hunters, Native Americans to this continent have been hunting these populations for 10,000 years. So it's like saying, oh, we're going to have these parks, no one can ever hunt these areas ever again. Well, that's actually, you're not even creating an accurate, I mean, I guess you're creating a pre-human ecosystem, but that, I mean, you're going back over 10,000 years and trying to create something that hasn't existed in a very, very long time. So I don't know if that's the best way to go about it. But another thing I want to mention is that, you know, you get a lot of not like, you know, you're not like the meat eater guys, like putting out hunting videos, content like that. But a lot of people that do, like influencers in the hunting and fishing space, people get, a lot of hunters and anglers get really mad at these people, like the Steven Rinella and Remy Warren and all these guys, these famous, you know, hunters and writers.
I know Remy, actually. He's a cool guy. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, seems like
I met
cool
him a
guy.
Few years ago. Yeah. Oh, he's legit. Like, he's hardcore.
Yeah.
I don't know the meat eater guys, but I know I have, like, mutual friends who know them. So.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It's interesting debate over, meat eater, you know, what lifestyle they're trying to portray. I think they've largely been successful. I don't agree with when they kind of steep into some of the political stuff. I disagree with them, especially about, like, multiple use and Antiquities Act. Sometimes they align with the left. Not Rinella himself, but some of his associates kind of lean a little more preservationist, or they don't understand, or they're like, well, this doesn't affect me, so I can support this type of deal.
Right.
Rinella, I would say, is a lot more understanding. He's not for gun control. He understands nuance a lot more. But no, back to your thing about rewilding. You can never, as I see it now, you can never restore the United States or any other continent, you know, any other country or continent even, to a pre-settlement state. That's what's at the core of rewilding. And that's what's at the core of a lot of these regulations, you know, to put back grizzly bears in their historic ranges. You'll never restore a grizzly bear's historic range or individual segment population. It's impossible to do that. And that just puts strains on people. It's not practical. And you'll never be able to return to a pre-settlement, you know, type of landscape. It's impossible. And then that would require getting rid of people, and we don't want that to happen.
It would require murdering tens of millions of human beings.
Let's not do that.
But with and I didn't mean to I don't mean Remy and Steve Rinell and these guys personally. I just mean like the hunting and fishing influencer.
Like a bro.
I just mean the people that do that for a living. A lot of hunters and anglers hate those guys because they don't want anybody else to hunt and fish, right? They don't want more guys showing up to their their piece of ground trying to chase bucks. They don't want competitions in the elk woods or in the swamp hunting ducks or their favorite fishing spot. They're like, you know, we don't want any more people hunting and fishing, you know, so they hate that, like, Meteor's probably the most popular one. So let's just use them as an example. Like, oh, like a million people are watching episodes of the show. You know, more people are going to hunt and fish, and, you know, that's bad for us. And it's like, guys, that is the most short-sighted mentality I can imagine. Because look at what's happening in Colorado. What's happening in Colorado is not enough people are lobbying their government and organizing to prevent this shit from happening. And, like, and that's a blue state. Like, you know, Colorado, obviously, not all Democrats are created equal. Polis is a heck of a lot more authoritarian than Hickenlooper was. But even in a Republican state like Ohio, the Department of Natural Resources, they keep taking stuff from us arbitrarily every single year. In the last decade, we've lost 2 weeks off the front of our deer season, our bow season.
Really?
Despite record numbers of deer across the state. There's more deer in Ohio than there was pre-European contact.
Wow.
To North America, and they still took 2 weeks off the front of our season. Our gun season is only a week long. It's the shortest in the nation for no reason. Like I said, there's more deer than ever. We have more deer and less hunters than the state of Michigan, and we have one-fifth the time that they have to hunt with a rifle. We're not allowed to use real rifles. We're only allowed to use straight wall rifles chambered in straight-walled cartridges, which are blown-up pistol cartridges, like a 357, 44 Magnum, or some of the more modern ones, 350 Legend, 450 Bushmaster, stuff like that. We're not allowed to use bottlenecked cartridges because they don't want us taking shots over 200 yards. They recently in Ohio banned all hunting and trapping within any city limit. In most states, I believe in the high 40s states in the country, you can bow hunt deer on properties over 5 acres. But DNR just changed the rules, said you're never allowed to hunt. You're never allowed to shoot a projectile of any kind at an animal within city limits. I don't care if you have 100 acres. So instead, the government just takes a bunch of tax dollars and they pay sharpshooters to come in and cull these deer. Apparently, it's worth it to these people to. And this is in a red state. This is in the state of Ohio, Republican governor, super majorities by Republicans of both houses of the state legislature, and they decided it's worth it to waste taxpayer dollars in order to screw hunters, just to screw hunters. I can't really think of any other objective otherwise. It seems more done out of spite for the hunting community as opposed to any kind of real science or biology. So I don't want to turn this into a Brady complains fest about his home state, but it's like it's everywhere. It's not just... You know, you see a guy, Jared Polis, and his husband is this career anti-hunter activist. It's not just there. I mean, it's happening in all kinds of states. We're a one-buck state. Most states are 2 bucks. Like I mentioned, even though there's more deer in Ohio than there was pre-European contact. So, I mean, even in states like Ohio, this is happening. We really have absolutely no recourse. They just say, go F yourself and, you know, whatever, vote harder, I guess. So these are Republicans doing this to us too, you know?
Yeah, no. So what was the justification? Why would they shorten it if they have an excess of deer? Because they said too many people are getting deer, or what
they
was
just
the justification?
They heard old Brady Leonard was having fun and you know, can't have that. I don't know. There's deer everywhere.
That is so strange. I mean, maybe someone... Maybe
strange
someone
isn't the word. I use different words other than strange, but yeah. No, I agree.
I have heard that this does happen in red states. I know it's not exclusive to blue states. It's maybe less overt, but for those who pay attention, you know, it certainly raises alarm bells. And you even have in places like Florida. Florida has a healthy bear population to establish a bear hunt, but Governor DeSantis doesn't want to create one. Or recommend one. I've heard different chatter that maybe his wife or someone close to him does not want that to happen. So this does happen in red states too, unfortunately, where you do see certain hesitance to either, you know, lengthen hunting season or approve new, or rather, different seasons for populations that have, you know, met the threshold of recovery or, you know, have exceeded their carrying capacity in a season is warranted, you know, once they reach a certain threshold. And so, yes, it does happen. You see the attacks more in blue states, but sometimes, yes, as you mentioned, this can happen in red states or purplish states if you're not careful, even with, you know, red supermajorities, because maybe it's a more urban population or maybe someone in the commission, and maybe indeed a DNR, maybe someone on the commission is, you know, pretends to be Republican, but supports these kind of anti-hunting platitudes. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I think that, you know, I firmly come down on the side of encouraging more people to hunt and fish and get involved.
Nobody loses. Because
if somebody shows up, there's an extra tree stand in the woods I'm hunting this year and somebody else kills a deer instead of me. I mean, it's a small price to pay. You know, if we have another generation of hunters who are involved, who vote based on their values, who write their politicians and their game agencies and complain and ask for explanations for all these things. And it's just not the whole, you know, hunters trying to preserve what's theirs is just not. And like, I understand that from, like, you know, all hunters and anglers get a little selfish, at least inwardly. And maybe we repent of those feelings immediately, but we all feel them. We all get a little jealous. If somebody has that great walleye hole and they catch a limit in 15 minutes and I'm freezing my nuts off out there all day catching nothing, like, yeah, it's like, oh, man, but it's worth it. We need more people involved. We need more people hunting. We need more people that understand the issues and care and can organize and lobby their government.
Absolutely. And even with more people hunting, you're not going to lose out on opportunities. I think that's a very misguided thinking. So I'm very much in agreement with you, Brady, on that. Because you need the people to sustain the funding and keep the funding in perpetuity and keep these activities alive to pass on to future generations. Because if you don't do that, if you disrupt the cycle, then these activities are going to be gone very soon.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple things I want to get to. We're not going to get to the EV mandates that are coming out today. I'm going to have to cover that next week because we are running out of time. But a couple things I have to get to before I let you go, Gabby. A couple weeks ago, I know this is old news. I was sick for a couple weeks. I didn't do the podcast at all last week because I lost my voice. I physically couldn't speak. There's a lot of old stuff. I know people hate it when I bring up old stuff because the news cycles recycle every 18 hours these days, it seems like. But Twitter a couple weeks ago went through one of its dumbest timelines I can remember, and even by Twitter standards, which is saying a lot. If you're like me who spends way too much time on Twitter, it's the collective IQ of that app seems to be declining by the day or even the hour, the minute, perhaps. I mean, we could log on after the show and finally decide we need to delete it permanently. I don't know. But anyway, a couple weeks ago, all these big right-wing trad accounts were attacking a woman named Hannah Baron, who I had never heard of, but apparently is a hunting and fishing influencer with a huge following, like a million followers on Instagram. And all these clownish trad accounts were attacking her because she's this pretty girl who hunts and fishes and is generally capable and helps her dad build homes and stuff like that. And they were all complaining how American women are like men and women should never get their hands dirty and shouldn't hunt and fish and all this. And Hannah handled it all with grace and laughed these dorks off, as she should. But you, as a woman who spends an inordinate amount of time in the outdoors, I have to imagine you have some thoughts on the topic.
I do. And I was happy to come to her defense. And it's funny, a lot of people were commenting like Hannah just emerged. She and I have a lot of mutual friends in the outdoor industry. I've never crossed paths with her personally, but I've seen her stuff and I don't see anything that is wrong to me. We often have debates in fishing about should you wear a bikini or not. That's separate from, I think, this discussion about her and kind of the archetype that she represents. But, you know, when you go noodling, you want to have not as much baggy clothing because, you know, you don't know what you're going to be encountering.
It's a safety. It's a safety. Yeah. It's a safety hazard.
And I mean, she's in great shape. I'm envious. I wish I had abs like her. I'm working my way towards that. But she's extremely athletic, naturally pretty. I believe she's married or has a boyfriend or fiance. She wears dresses and she just does, you know, the outdoor lifestyle really well. I can't think of a better person representative than her, speaking as someone who has, you know, a lot of clout. Like, she has a lot of followers across Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. Like, she grew up doing these activities with her dad, and I bet you in their relationship it sounds very similar to mine and my dad's. He wanted her to be tough, but he wasn't forcing her to become masculine. Like, these activities do not make you masculine or a tomboy, so to speak. You know, a lot of women do these activities. Some women, I don't do this. Like, if I'm going fishing and hunting and I know I'm going to be doing a lot of that, you know, in a certain time frame, I do not paint my nails. I envy my female friends who can hunt or shoot guns with painted nails. That terrifies me. I don't like doing that because I chip my nails easily. I'm just like, no, I just prefer to like keep my nails not painted, whatever. You can't dress in a dress while fishing and hunting. It doesn't really make sense. So you're going to opt for like shorts and a t-shirt or tank top, whatever, pants even too. But you could still look good. You know, you could wear makeup in some of these instances for hunting. I've actually heard that sometimes wearing makeup is very off-putting to different species. So if I don't have to, I don't wear concealer or, you know, eyeshadow or whatever. If it ticks off the certain species that are very sensitive to different smells, I can go barefaced or I can go with makeup, whichever, you know, to my choosing. Some women fully go with makeup, have no problem. They land big bucks. They catch big fish. No big deal. You know, a woman who hunts and fishes can choose how she does it. She could put, you know, she can cake her face in makeup or she can do it au natural, you know. So we're not really limited, you know, as to what we can and cannot do. And you're not really losing your femininity when you're choosing to do these activities. Interestingly enough, some studies have shown in recent years, typically we think of, you know, women getting introduced to these outdoor activities from their fathers or their spouses or boyfriends, what have you. And that's typical. But we are now seeing trends in fishing in particular. I'm not sure if this is in hunting, but in fishing from the Recreational Boating and Fishing Foundation, they have done extensive study into this and have found that women, mothers, are actually the primary drivers now of introducing their kids to fishing, which is very fascinating to me. And I love that. I love hearing about that. And of course, fathers are still very integral in teaching their daughters or their sons how to fish. But we see women now starting to do that. And it's not taboo or abnormal to see women, you know, fishing for a long time or coming from generations of fishing. And like we were talking about going before going online and recording, there was a study that showed, I think it was last year. I don't know if you read this in the New York Times, but it was from a study. I forget where it was, but the New York Times wrote about how women have actually been hunting for millennia. And actually women were involved 100% of the time in hunting in hunter-gatherer societies.
Yes.
So I don't know where these influencers got the idea that American women can't go hunting. Yes, as we became more industrialized as a civilization, we probably saw fewer women go hunting and providing for their families in that way, especially as opportunities increase. But we've seen kind of a, you know, resurgence of that as women, you know, become more educated, they have careers, families, juggle both, you know, choose to do one or the other, whatever. Women are rediscovering these activities, even if they've been removed from them, you know, from their predecessors or from their ancestors. And it's not unusual to see American women do this, and even European women and African women and even Asian women. Like they're,
yes,
this is not just exclusive to the United States. I know a lot of women from Europe, from Latin America, from South America, Africa, who love to hunt and fish too. It's not like a cultural thing, so to speak. Like it's not always on social media like it is here because, you know, this is America. We have probably some of the highest levels of users, you know, of Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or all these other apps. We're just very social media savvy here, and other countries can be too. But for here, it's just, I don't know, people associate hunting and fishing, conservation with the United States mostly because we have really good laws that welcome that and a culture that invites you to go outdoors to showcase the beauty of what it is, you know, not only to get a harvest or a catch, but also to see unique stuff, wildlife, beautiful vistas and landscapes. Maybe you bonded over some sort of mishap or you learned about your family story or you made friends with someone who's much older, who's been hunting in this place for decades and maybe they're 90 or I don't know, they impart some wisdom on you. You can do so much in hunting and fishing, even if you don't have success, let's say on the water or in the field. Like it's so much more than just the catch or the harvest or the kill shot. It's all encompassing and
it's problem solving. It's just like, cause you've never
meditative too.
Yeah.
Spiritual,
the thing is about hunting and fishing is that there's never been in the history of the world, maybe fishing. Occasionally you just go out and it's just slam dunk and they're just jumping in the boat or whatever. But like in terms of hunting, there's never been a day in my life where things have gone how I thought they were going to go.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like hunting is just, you go out and you solve problems in real time. You just figure things out. Why is this happening? What's not working? What do I do about it? And it's just, you're constantly, you're training your brain to become more capable and to solve problems, complex scenarios in real time.
And going back to Hannah too, it was really encouraging to me to see, even amongst this kind of trad wife, red pill craziness we talked about before going online, and we won't inundate your listeners with our grievances with these really weird people and individuals. I wouldn't even say it's conservative. We have people who used to be leftists who now have kind of claimed to be trad or conservative, but they're not really. So it's a weird hodgepodge of characters. But what I was encouraged by was the men who came to Hannah's defense. They said, you know, compared to the influencer who was very heavily made up and very just nasty, they were like, I would much prefer a well-adjusted female like Hannah Baron over this girl who, funny enough, praised the Taliban at some point. She was a Kremlin RT correspondent, and she was so radical for Kremlinites, they fired her from RT because she said Stalin's gulags were great. So this lady who was attacking Hannah,
I didn't know who that woman was, by the way.
Yeah.
But that's
if people
hilarious.
Knew her backstory, they'd be like, she's even crazier than I thought. So
that's so great.
Even though, you know, these attacks lobbed on Hannah were very ugly, I think social media jumped in and reacted positively and said, no, this is what women, I mean, should be or should be fine with doing. And it doesn't make her less attractive or less feminine or less fun to be around. By all accounts and purposes, she looks like a well-adjusted young woman, very happy in herself. And she pokes fun at the teaser. She's like tomboy. And then she puts herself in a dress near tanks. So it's like, I know a lot of guys get very excited by that kind of stuff too. So she can balance out, you know, the doing really hardcore stuff with looking very fit and attractive and feminine. And so women don't have to choose between the two. Like, we can do everything if we want to and still look good doing so. And I also think people are like, well, these women are only fishing for male attention or hunting for male attention. I mean, if men like that were doing that, that's an added bonus. That's not why we choose to go outdoors. I never did this to get approval from men. I even encountered, you know, not so much in my professional life, but growing up, my dad always said, you know, if someone gives you a hard time for fishing, you tell them your dad taught you how to fish and he says that you have a seat at the table and you're welcomed here. So you encounter kind of these old fogies who are like, girls shouldn't be fishing and hunting. They're dying out. They're going the way of the dinosaurs, thankfully.
Was the funniest attack on her, by the way.
Yes.
That she's only doing it for male attention. Like,
it's so stupid.
It's like, you know this better than anybody. Like, if all right, hunting and fishing, like, for the uninitiated, hunting and fishing is really hard. Okay?
It can be easy.
Like, it takes a long time. It takes a lifetime of work to get good at it. It's difficult. You're in extreme heat, extreme cold. You're climbing mountains. You're doing physically arduous tasks. It's like, no one is going to do that as much as this woman does for attention. It's just not like, there's just easier ways to get attention from the opposite sex. Like, nobody's doing it for attention. I'm sorry. Like, it's just it's too much work. It's too difficult. It's too time consuming to be doing it for ulterior motives. Like, I don't know. Like, unless you're a poacher, maybe you're doing it for nefarious motives, but like, no, like that's just like at face value, that attack is hilarious.
It's so funny. I wish that was an effective tool here in DC, because fishing and hunting pictures do not excite men in the DC area. They're like, what? This is so weird.
A bunch of girly guys that they're all worried about breaking their nail, and they just painted their nails. They don't want to, you know, they don't want to chip a nail. That's the issue.
No, it's just so funny. And it's like, I go to a lot of these trade shows. I've gone to like SHOT Show. I've gone to ICAST, which is like the SHOT Show of fishing. And there's so many women who come to these events, like any trade show, regional, state, national, like women have been going to these for a long time and they've been making their voices heard and they're very involved. And the men love that. You know, it's not because like, oh, more pretty women to look at. A lot of them are married or have girlfriends. And they're just like, it's good to see the sport grow because we're not losing. If we have women fishing and hunting, it means they're going to multiply, be a force multiplier, and bring in more people. Maybe they have sons. Maybe they have male friends who are a little removed from hunting and fishing. So it's not a subtraction. It's an addition. And if we can have good influencers like Hannah over like a lot of these really annoying types, like, I would much prefer that. Like, influencer marketing and influencers are kind of on their way out. Like, companies are starting to not so much budget for that type of expense, because people and even influencers themselves are like, or rather, social media users are responding negatively to influencers, saying like, you're advertising this really expensive lifestyle that's going to be out of reach for me. I'm turning you off. I'm unfollowing you. So users are doing their own due diligence, following what, you know, influential people,
right,
you know, or following influential people rather, who are positive, not forcing them to have to like, you know, go along with societal pressure. So in a world of influencers, I think having Hannah Baron types is far more welcome than these other weird kind of like trad wife, fake yes. in a very fancy dress, sourdough bread types who are somewhat engaged in sexual fetishes. I've heard that this kind of weird trad wife it's been kind of emanated from these really like rabbit hole sexual fetish websites. Like, so that's really irking to me that's the case. Not surprising that that's where it stems from too. But yeah, more Hannah Barons over kind of high caked, you know, baked caked type of influencers don't really add anything to the discussion. They're just clickbait and engagement.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But once all this blew up on Twitter a couple weeks ago, I went to Hannah's Instagram. The girl could absolutely put game down, by the way. She's an assassin. She's out hunting elk, pronghorn, giant bucks. Yeah, obviously a very effective and deadly predator. So killed more game than I have. So, you know, goodness gracious. I will say one more thing before we move on. She has a ton of noodling videos and pictures. I've caught a million catfish in my life. I've never noodled.
Thing.
I know. And I've spent a lot of time down south. I've spent a ton of time down south. And I've fished in like every southern state. I fished in 30 states probably. But when I was on tour with the band, we would bring all of our fishing gear with us. And that anytime we had a day off, we'd go fishing. Yeah. So I fished all, coast to coast, all over the place. I've caught everything. But never noodle because I'm not saying I won't. I'm sure I'll try it eventually. But I just focus on the stuff I'm going to eat. And I throw the giant flatheads back. You know, like, no, I'm not going to feed my family a 15-year-old 75-pound flathead. Unless they're really hungry. You know, I keep the 20-pounders and throw the... let the old dinosaurs live to fight another day.
That's a good strategy with it. Yeah, noodling, I would be afraid of the snakes underwater. Like, I'm outdoorsy, but I have my limitations. I hate to admit that. It doesn't sound very strong and empowered of me to say that. But you can have your limitations of how you hunt and how you fish. You know, I think it's a deep south kind of thing. And, I mean, you have to wear gloves. Like, there are a lot of safety concerns entailed with noodling. You have to, you know, reach into these little crevices and, you know, grab the catfish from the mouth and then wrestle it and wrangle it and, you know, get your gripping grin and then put it back to go about its happy, merry way. And it's neat. And that's how she rose to fame, like, I think at least five, seven years ago. So she's been doing this for a while. This is not new. And they just latched onto her because that's what these weird red pill, trad bot, whatever types do. They find something or someone to get angry over. They were upset over Southern girls dancing at a gas station. Then there was...
fully clothed. Fully, you know, clothed, like nothing. They weren't
nothing
drunk.
Raunchy.
It wasn't, yeah.
And I'm just like, they're just looking for things to pick at because that's how they can supply their engagement bait, make money on Twitter.
Yeah.
That's what I hate, how the new Twitter has evolved into. Like, it's not the same. Like, there were problems with Twitter leadership absolutely before, but I hate to say this, like, Musk Twitter is kind of disappointing me because I'm seeing more porn bots.
It's
seeing engagement bots. I don't, my posts don't get seen as far much because I'm not driving engagement in a very, you know, controversial way to my tweets, you know? So I just hate that it's incentivizing terrible people to make money. And then we learn and find out they don't believe in this stuff. They're just doing it to provoke people.
Oh, it's all a grift. It's all a grift. Yeah. I know. I was happy when he bought Twitter, like, you know, he seems somewhat, at least at face value, committed to free speech. And I appreciate that.
I like that too. Yeah.
But I don't pay for I don't give him the $12 a month or whatever for premium. So my engagement declined by about 2,000% overnight, and has never came back. I mean, hardly anybody sees my stuff anymore. And then when Elon's, I remember it took me about 5 seconds of contemplation to realize that it was a terrible mistake. When Elon said he was going to start paying people for engagement, I was like, well, you know, as a capitalist, I'm, you know, hey, you know, they're providing, you know, value to the company. It's good that Elon's sharing a little bit with the people providing the value, whatever, that seems fair. And then oh my goodness, no. I'm like, oh no, that means, you know, people are gonna are now incentivized to just say the most inflammatory, ridiculous things just to drive up. That's why, you know, you see guys like what's his name, Tim Pool. He'll just tweet every day, like 5 times a day. It's like, civil war, exclamation point, all caps, and then have like 1,000 comments. And it's like, guys, you're just incentivizing stupid people to become stupider for money. And like, this is a terrible mistake. So I totally agree with you that, Twitter's really gone downhill. Before I let you go, we were going to do a half an hour and we did an hour and a half. So I know we're way over time and I got to let you go. But, real quick, what's your hunting and fishing schedule for the year look like? For me, my New Year's is essentially March 1st. That's where like my hunting and fishing calendar starts. And because most of the seasons end in January and then I shut it down in February. Ain't shit going on in February. Not allowed to hunt anything unless you really want to freeze your tail off and try to ice fish for crappie. There's really nothing else going on. So I shut it down. And then, you know, right now I'm looking at the walleye run just started. Be fishing for the next few months, fish all summer. I'm actually not hunting turkeys this year, which kind of sucks, but I'll get back to that next year. And then small game in the fall, waterfowl, deer, upland. But yeah, walleye's first thing. What does your annual hunting and fishing calendar look like this year?
Ooh, great question. I am hoping to do some trout fishing. I like to do, you know, in response to the stocking that happens, but like they all get fished out by the time I eventually go to these public waters. So if I'm feeling
you're not
a little
there within 18 hours, it's yeah. over.
Yes. If I'm a little disillusioned by that, I go to a private trout farm, which is like, you know, an agribusiness, and I fish for my trout. So it's much cheaper than buying it at the grocery store. So I'm thinking that's going to be on the horizon. It's a great little Virginia trout farm. Pretty reasonable rates. You catch your catch and dinner, you know, so it's great. Maybe I think some spring turkey is going to be on the horizon for me. I'm going to be going to South Carolina in May for Outdoor Media Association I'm involved in where I'm secretary, and I have a bass fishing trip lined up for me. I believe it is May 6th, sometime then. So I do have some bass fishing on the horizon for me. I think I'm going to revisit a charter captain that I go with, that I've gone with before. We were supposed to go last year. Hurricane weather came through the region, but he's one of the best. You know, the Red Drum, we talked about this. The Red Drum that I caught is through CME Charters that is run by Captain Sean Shapiro out of Norfolk, Virginia. One of the best captains, fishing guides ever in the region. I'm biased. I've gone with someone else. He was a nice guy, but he didn't really put us on the board. But Captain Sean is one of the best, like, Red Drum fishing captains in Virginia you'll ever find. And so we're hoping to do maybe a similar trip with him, my dad, some friends, sometime in the summertime. So I'm hoping for that. Hopefully to do some deer hunting successfully a little earlier and see what that's all about. There will probably be some other fishing trips sprinkled in. I can't anticipate exactly what that is. And I think I'm going to go down to Florida by the end of the year to do what is called duck ranching. Friends of mine have launched this kind of cooperation between ranchers and waterfowlers because ranch land is really good duck habitat. So they created this brand and kind of company or guiding business. And I really want to highlight what that's all about, having worked with them before for different conservation projects. So I anticipate, you know, doing a lot of sprinkling of fishing, some big game fishing, some, you know, typical fishing that I normally do, hopefully some more successful hunts. I applied for a Virginia elk lottery tag. I don't know if I'm going to get it. If I do get that, you know, it's a 1 in 50,000 shot that you're going to get
yeah.
that.
I was going to ask, what are your odds?
Ooh, I mean, they only issue 5 tags from the lottery itself and then a 6th tag from the conservation component. So I think typically it's 5 on the lottery outright and then there's an additional. So only 6 people of like 50,000 are going to be able to hunt elk during mid-October. If I am lucky to somehow draw a tag, that's what I would be doing in mid-October. I'd be going down to southwestern Virginia and hopefully getting a bull elk because that's what's allowed with the lottery. In Virginia, I don't know if that's going to happen. I've applied. This is now the 3rd year that I've been able to apply since they started the lottery hunt. If I'm lucky, great. If not, it's okay. I'm going to, you know, swallow my pride and try again next year.
Is it like out west how you accumulate points or is it just
there's no
best
point
of luck? That
is
unfortunate.
It is on one hand, but it's okay because they have a rule where if someone were to draw once, they have to wait 3 years before they can draw again.
Right.
With the tag. So I kind of like that. So it's not repeating. And you really get an interesting mix of applicants for that. So I love it because the money's going back to conservation. Right. Even if I don't draw, but I'm hoping myself or my dad can draw because we love that region of Virginia. What they're doing there, restoring the elk population, is absolutely beautiful. It's wonderful. It's this nice confluence of energy workers and private landowners and the DWR. And they've brought back elk, you know, to healthy numbers. And it's nice to see more elk on Appalachia. On the Appalachian front. And it's a very good success story. I think last year there was $500,000 drawn from all the tags that were, you know, applied for. So it's helping the elk. It's good for Virginia's economy. kind of giving a boost to that region, which has been really been hard hit, you know, from economic downturns, from heavy regulation against energy projects to floods, hurricanes. So great salt of the earth people. I hope I can go back there with an elk tag in my hands. But even if not, it's okay.
We could do a whole podcast on the history of elk in this country, too. Hey, people don't know that elk used to have a larger, wider range than the white-tailed deer. They're coast to coast, all the way down to Florida. And it's cool. I mean, it's cool that you guys have a season in Virginia. And there's a season in Kentucky now. I believe there's a season in Pennsylvania as well. They're talking about eventually a season in West Virginia. I don't know if North Carolina. I don't know where North Carolina's at. But I know they've reintroduced some in North Carolina. Oh, they do have one. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, none of that existed. So it's super cool. And that's a lot of in no small part to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, who took these animals and reintroduced them. It's super cool. So, no, that's awesome. Best of luck hunting, fishing this year. What's your deer? Because I know somebody would ask in the comments, what's your deer hunting setup, bow wise and rifle wise? Like what rifle? What cartridge? What are you slinging at whitetails?
I've largely done gun rifle shooting. I actually got my first deer on an AR platform. I don't recall the exact caliber now that it's been almost 4 years since I did it, but I did it on an AR platform. You can shoot deer on an AR platform. Mm-hmm. And it works out great. The last deer hunt I went on, I actually did a muzzleloader when I got one in Georgia a year or so ago. So that was fun. And this past year I went hunting for deer on a bolt action rifle and didn't see anything or get anything, but bolt action is fun too. So I'm privy to anything, you know, muzzleloader. I could do rifle. I could do bolt action rifle. And I just got a bow and I still need to learn how to use it. So I'm hoping in the future I will be able to do hunting with my bow, with my new Matthews archery bow, left-handed bow.
That's cool. That's cool. I actually use a crossbow during bow season.
Crossbow's great too. Everyone knocks on crossbows all the time, which is so silly, but I think they're fine to use.
I mean, you know, people that knock crossbows, I mean, I missed a buck this past year with a rifle. So, I mean, hunting is difficult. You know, you're dealing with a lot of different factors. It's not, people think, oh, you're making it easy on yourself with a crossbow. I'm like, it's still a bow and arrow. It's still going south of 400 feet per second. Okay. You know, you're still limited to 40 yards. Trust me. It's not a gimme because you're using a crossbow. And then, yeah, I prefer bolt actions. I have my ARs, you know, and I know a lot of people that have big bore, you know, AR-10s that you're allowed to deer hunt with here in Ohio. But I just like bolt actions. If something happens, you can field strip it, put it back together in 30 seconds. You're not dealing with a whole bunch of moving parts and gas and everything else you're dealing with an AR. Not that there's any problem with hunting with an AR, but I just, you know, if you drop your rifle, you get something in the barrel, you can just pop the bolt right out, look down the barrel, fix the issue, and get back to hunting, you know, which I like just the simplicity, I guess. But that's cool. So fishing this spring, hunting deer in the fall, best of luck with the elk tag. That'd be great. I might have to come join you just to lay some eyes on elk. I haven't seen an elk in person in 10 years. So it's
take your family with you because it's a really cool tourist draw. Like they have elk tours all the time. It's really fun.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's awesome. So Gabby, plug all your stuff. Where can everybody read your stuff? Where can everybody check out and subscribe to your podcast, which I highly recommend? I will retweet your podcast out right under this one once this is out. Give us all the plugs. Where can everybody keep in touch?
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, IWF.org. My byline is there with all my policy work. You can follow District of Conservation. Subscribe if you feel inclined. I also have a Conservation Nation video series, so you can see what I do on the storytelling front as well. I have a website, GabriellaHoffman.com, where all of my stuff is kind of inhabited at and can be found. And I'm very approachable. So if you have any questions or want to learn more about my work or how to get involved in conservation, I'm more than happy to answer. And Brady, I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and talk to you about these fun topics.
Absolutely. You're welcome here anytime. Everybody check out the show. It's fantastic. Everybody follow Gabby. She's great. That's all I got for today. I'm Brady Leonard. I'll be back on Monday. No gimmicks.